Oldie Lunch Recordings presents Landskipping, Painters, Ploughmen and Places by Anna Pavord. Brought to you by Doro, number one in Bassinia Mobile Market.
Our last speaker, finally, writes lyrically of... I'll do my poem slowly. What? Where's she gone now?
Yes.
Ah, she's back. Yes? Our final speaker writes lyrically of landskipping, painters, ploughmen and places, skipping and tripping across our landscape. All aboard and applaud. Finally, we welcome Anna Pavord.
Well, we could have had the decency to have given him better surnames to have to rhyme with. You've done brilliantly. And I have the grave misfortune to follow two completely brilliant public speakers. So I'm glad you put me at the end. But I'm going to speak about a subject so different to both of these that it's really sort of a very abrupt change of gear. But I'm going to start with my own childhood, because I was born and brought up on the border country between England and Wales. And there was one very dominant feature of the landscape there, which was a mountain, I called it a mountain, at 1,200 foot, pointed, called the Sugarloaf. Very steep. And wherever you were in my childhood amongst my uncle's farms, you could see this amazing cone rising into the sky. Now, the sides were steep. Steep enough for the trees that covered the Rolbin and the Derry and the Llanwenneth Breast to give up as they tried to climb its sides. Too steep for me, too, as a child, but my mother insisted that we climbed it very often, because round the back of the Sugarloaf, where it went into the Black Mountains, there was a place where globe flowers grew. Now, these were rather rare in our place, and so we made this pilgrimage every year at the time that they were flowering, up the Sugarloaf, round the back, into the slightly damp, boggy valley where my mother could stand and pay homage to these amazingly beautiful flowers, globe-shaped indeed as their name, but the curious, soft, milky lemon color. And then we would come back, and then that would be it for that year for the globe flower she knew, just that one journey. But she was a woman who, in a very old-fashioned sense, was a most amazing botanist. She could name every grass and every field that she walked through. She'd been born into, she'd been married into this landscape, and it was deeply imbued with her. When we were at the top of the Sugarloaf, she could actually look out over the glittering valley laid down below with the usk winding its way through the fields, and she could name the owner of every field that we were looking at. So this business of landscape became stitched into me too, and the extent to which it was stitched into her was actually figured on the day that I was actually swatting for a geometry O-level, and I came home from school and found my mother waiting with a picnic in a basket, and we climbed the Sugarloaf, and we sat down to spring, and I thought, well, this is very nice, but somehow surprising. And then she brought out a geometry textbook and tested me on my theorems. So Pythagoras is for me endlessly knitted into that sort of damp turf and the smell of bracken and the slight bubbling noise of the spring rising at our feet. The square on the hypotenuse has never been the same since. But it is interesting how, in a curious way, you are unaware of what is being stitched into you as a child. I was unaware that not all children, for instance, had their hand taken and actually put round the stem of a wild nettle. And my mother would say, feel, square. Only one group of plants, she wouldn't have spoken like this, but she stitched it into me. One group of plants has that square stem. And she gave me the Latin for it, labiati. I took this absolutely for granted as a child. All children were being stitched into these things, and of course, they weren't. So at this stage in my life, I decided I wanted to write some sort of homage to landscape as a way of saying my thanks to all that it has given me, the way that it has sustained me, and the way that actually it has produced awe and wonder and delight and above all, solace. And so the book that I wrote actually fell into three parts. The first part was exploring this business of painters and landscape. We must have supposed, living in such an extraordinary, varied country, that painters had always painted our landscape, but they didn't. They only did it when they couldn't get to Italy because of Napoleon and what he was doing. So Richard Wilson, the man who's called the father of English landscape, died a pauper towards the end of the 18th century. But after him, the deluge, just think of those amazing painters that we can see in our National Gallery. Turner, Constable, the Cousinses, Sandby, Thomas Jones, staggering. So that by 1810, landscape painting was dominating the scene. So that was an interesting discovery, that actually it happened so late with us, this business of landscape painting. The second part of the book follows an entirely different band of men who are the agricultural improvers, the men who went out, commissioned by the Board of Agriculture, set up in 1793, to bring in reports of everything that was going on in every single county in the country, and actually say what crops are being grown, what animals are being bred, what wastes there are to improve. They were, of course, on the side of the improvers. And then the third part of the book actually looks at what stitches us in to particular places. We, of course, are stitched in to the place that we are born. These places are etched in our souls. We can never get rid of them because it happened in one place that we were born. It was the unchosen place, but it is still incredibly important to us. But it just so happens that actually I did not stay in the place that I was born, even though on my deathbed, I will still see that particular landscape of the Sugarloaf. That's the landscape that is so deep there. That is the one at the end I shall think of. But for more than 40 years now, I've lived in West Dorset. There are similarities. Are we looking for similarities? Or are we actually wanting to escape and discover the excitement of new, tougher, richer, odder places? There are similarities, but there are also deep differences. West Dorset is a place of yeoman farmers, pastoral farming, not of the rough, high moorland country which dominated my childhood. So I live amongst steep hills, deep valleys, hedges, which are etched out in a succession of bloom with the blackthorn and with the hawthorn and with the elder. I live in a place that actually, just up the valley, there are two settlements, North and South Porton, both of them mentioned in the Domesday Book as thriving agricultural settlements, and they still are. I live in a place where, as the sun goes down in the evening, all the old people who have been there before us start, as it were, arriving out of the landscape. Their villas, the Roman villas, arrive as the long shadows show them. There are those pits where stone was built for the first sort of settlements to be made. There are disc barrows, there are lynchets along the hillside. All these things, the marks of man's hand upon a landscape. And I realize actually that is what moves me most. It is this combination of the managed with the wild, these marks of people trying to make a living from a land which actually is giving it only very, very, as it were, ungratefully. But looking out towards these places, you actually see time and time again how what really matters is the way that the light strikes it, how the shadows move round a particular scene from left to right as the sun makes its trajectory from east to west, how in the winter, when the sun is low on the horizon, these shadows start creeping down over a valley and then climbing up the other side of a hill. It is light that actually is the essential part of one's fascination with the landscape. And you realize also how the landscape has both ephemeral but also timeless, which seems to be a contradiction in terms. But if you do as I did and actually commissioned a photographer to take a photograph of the same view over a period of a year, it makes you notice these small changes in the land as that year progresses. And it was the most amazing exercise for me to have done that and to lay all these photographs down in the room in which I was working. And from that came one of the chapters of the book. So this, for me, was a departure. I've been known, if at all, as a writer about gardens and about plants. But I had this chance to seize 5 years of delving, of thinking, of walking above all, and also of discovering that you can still find these places that hit you in the pit of the stomach and you say, that is so extraordinary. And it happened first time I went to West Arros. I came up the west coast, I turned in and saw for the first time Loch Carron and the wonderful assemblage of light on the hills beyond. And I've been back there ever since. This is a discovery that's open to us all, a landscape that suddenly takes your heart and which makes you feel that actually this is a place where you could also have put down roots if chance had actually brought you here sooner. So I'm just going to end with a quotation from the man who I think writes about landscape probably better than anybody else that I know, and that's R.S. Thomas. I have seen the sun break through to illuminate a small field for a while and gone my way and forgotten it. But that was the pearl of great price, the one field that had treasure in it. I realize now that I must give all that I have to possess it. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for the Oldie magazine. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.